Then we'll turn this on. Maybe. All right. We're on. Hi. You want to be able to see that? Okay. Maybe. It's a reminder for those of you who need to take the eco exam again. Julie's administering it after class here. You just stay right here and just do it. Get it over with. Yes.
Can you talk about assignment 5?
Can I talk about assignment 5? I don't know. Probably. The question is assignment 5, and thank you for asking. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you feel like you were knocking me off balance, but you did, because I wasn't anticipating that at all. Okay, for those of you who are thinking about assignment 5 and looking forward to drafting it on the beaches of some wonderful spot, or if you're just hanging around home and don't have anything else to do and want to do it, this is assignment 5. And this is an optional assignment. Okay? Right. This one is not required. It's optional. And it is worth a maximum of 25 points. And it is due on the 30th. And the intent... is written up there, but I can't read it from over there, so I'm going to go up here and read it, for those of you who can't read it. Okay, sort out Bronfenbrenner's framework and sort out from it a clear statement of your understanding of what conditions of the ecosystem are most supportive of human development. This will require that you study the hypotheses pertinent to each element of the system, and try to abstract the important features and then synthesize them into a set of principles that express how an ideal ecosystem would operate. It should take you 2 to 3 pages. It should be complete, straightforward, clear, and effectively written. Okay, what does all that mean? What it means is that as you look at the developology hypotheses and the conditions of the ecosystem, you can think about it in terms of what would be best for development, what conditions, what nature, what would be the characteristics of an ecosystem that would be ideal for a developing person. That's what Bronfenbrenner is trying to tell us. But he's not straightforward about that. He has a whole bunch of complex hypotheses to try to get us to think about that. So what I would like you to do is to see if you can sort out from those hypotheses what would be the most beneficial kind of relationship or dyad for a person to be in to maximize their development, their developmental potential. What would be the characteristics of molar activities? What kind of microsystem? You can run all these off in your head now probably, but microsystem. What would be the characteristics of the mesosystem? How would settings be related to each other and connected to maximize the potential of that mesosystem for development? What would be the ideal characteristics of an exosystem? Okay. So just now that you've been through it,
And you've applied it in different ways, including in exercise 4, to your own life. Can you spell out in a couple of pages what would be an ideal ecosystem? So it would be a statement which said, the ideal ecosystem would. The following kinds of dyads, the following kinds of mesosystem, the following features of the microsystem. Or just pull it out, put it into plain English, and see if you can figure out what an ideal world would look like to support development. Now, you don't have to go outside his system, just his definitions and hypotheses, to pull out from that what would be the ideal. Okay, just a translation exercise. And it's optional. And for those of you who take HDFS 161 next fall, hang on to it. It doesn't matter for this course whether you do it or not, but you're going to have to do it in 161 at the very beginning, so you might as well do it. Okay. What are we going to do with them? We're going to grade them. And then I'm going to take them all together and I'm going to write another chapter for the book. Why not? I started to do that and then I said, hey, why not let you do that? So I'll give you credit for it. Anything else I need to say about assignment 5? Keep it simple, keep it short, keep it sweet. Okay. Good. And again, it's optional. It's points, but it's optional. Any other questions? Okay, I already said that. If you didn't make yesterday's group session, if you can't stay for today's, then schedule something individual with Julie or with me, and do it as soon as you can. At some point that I haven't bothered to look up, the number of points that you can earn by passing it goes down, but that's not for a little while. Do we know when that is? No, we don't. Okay. We know the last day to pass it, but we don't know when it drops again. Okay. All right. Why do you have a half sheet of paper in your hand with something strange on? Another question. You didn't get one. Greg? Anybody else not have a half sheet of paper? And it has something strange on it, like adolescent development assignment, HDFS 295. What? Okay. On the blank side of that sheet of paper, put your name. Legibly. And then write briefly. What are the most common problems you and people you know encounter in romantic relationships? And turn off your cell phone, please. That was the assignment for Monday. You were thinking about that anyway, so. Okay, and then if you'll pass those to the aisles, Greg and Julie will collect them, and then we can talk about them. And the reason that you need to have your name on it is that it's worth 2 automatic points just for being here. Okay, what are some of them? What happens? Okay, one of the issues is that people are mobile, particularly young people, and one of the issues in relationships is that people come together for a period of time in one setting, like college, and establish a relationship, but their developmental trajectories are not coincidental. They're not going in the same direction. So graduation comes, job opportunities, graduate school, whatever comes along, and it's difficult to maintain a primary relationship when you're no longer sharing a major part of your mental system. People assign different meanings to different words and actions, and they disagree about those. And we have semantic arguments that get really serious often. Why does that happen? Why do people develop different meanings for different words, for the same word? Those of you who had HDFS-5, just apply the major viewpoint in development to that question. It's one of the realities of the fact that we each construct our knowledge and our understanding individually. A constructivist viewpoint captures that fact, that people develop their own reference from their own experience, their own reference for particular words. And one of the difficulties in communication is that we are using the same word, but our reference are individually constructed, and we often don't discover that we don't have the same understanding of the word. So people make commitments, but their assumptions are different. Their understanding of how those commitments fit into a larger context just don't match. And then they go off on different tangents, and they have conflict. That's a fundamental problem in human beings, in human relationships. The language is imprecise, but it's a fact of development. So how do you overcome that? Discussion. Discussion. You have to talk about what words mean, and what your understanding of the connotations, the implications of the words are. You have to explore that more elaborately than just using the word and accepting it. Yeah. So you get to ask, what do you mean by that? Under what conditions? It makes you look like you're over-intellectualizing everything, but if you don't, what happens? What happens when people don't understand each other is that they often play games. And playing games means what? How do you?
So there are several games. There's several possible games based on not understanding the world in the same way. And one of the games is to pretend that you do. So we often do that. We assume we don't really know how much we disagree, but the other person clearly wants us to agree, so we play the game of course I agree with you. And that's called talking the talk. You can use the same words and never examine the different understandings. But then when push comes to shove, or the waste products hit the fan, and you have the reality of seeing how somebody is behaving, you may discover that the words and the agreement about what you were going to do doesn't match the person's expectations of behavior. The person's response to you is not consistent with what you assumed he or she meant when he or she agreed with you. So one of the games is the agreement game. A second game is challenge, and that's a way of dealing with the differences. So you question and criticize, as I understand that game, you question and criticize the other person's understanding in the interest of trying to get the person to agree with yours by challenging the other person. And that's the way many of us play that game. Rather than trying to understand what the other person means, we try to defeat what the other person means and convince the other person that our understanding is correct. In a true give and take, where there's reciprocity, the task is to understand what the other person means, and that means questioning, but not necessarily criticizing, and certainly not rejecting. But you do need to talk about what it is that you both mean. And the game that you can replace the developmentally ineffective game with is the game of, let me see if I really understand you. Yeah. What does that mean? To me it means this. How does that fit with what you mean? And if you read the Pepper Schwartz article, Love is Not All You Need, for today, one of the things that she describes for couples who are happy is the ability to really listen, the ability to make the other person feel that you really do understand his or her viewpoint, and that when there are differences, you deal with those creatively and not destructively. Those were points. If you noticed my facial expression a few minutes ago while you were writing, I was up here being pissed because we share a printer in the office, and I had a summary of Pepper Schwartz's points that I printed out a while ago, and obviously somebody else. That happens regularly in the office, so you run. Who has my Pepper Schwartz? And somebody will return it. It'll show up on the table, but I don't have it, so I can't put that up there. So you have to go read it yourself, and then I'll put it on the web. Other games. Okay, the I agree with you game, the I'm going to convince you that you're wrong and I'm right game. And sometimes the I'm going to mess with your head game. You mentioned that one. Right? And the way that game often works is that one of the ways that I assert my power over you is that I'm going to twist your words. I'm going to convince you that the way you understand something isn't quite right and doesn't quite apply in this situation or doesn't quite apply to me. And I'm going to shift regularly what I assert a particular word or a particular statement might mean or what I think. And I'm going to do that without ever taking responsibility for the fact that I'm the one who's shifting. And if you do that regularly as a game, you can drive the other person nuts. And some people really like to mess with other people's heads.
And one of the pieces of advice I give, Uncle Larry advice, is when you're with somebody for a period of time and you begin to feel crazy, it's probably the other person who's making you crazy, and you want to step back and think about that. Because people who are messing with your head will make you feel crazy. And most of us will think, you know, it's just me. I don't understand. I'm not smart enough. And we let people mess with our heads rather than stepping back and say, you know, if I feel crazy, you're probably doing that. Now, there's something in the interaction, the transaction. And it may be completely innocent on the other person's part. I'll tell you a quick personal story. I had a mentor, actually, who became a very, very dear friend. He had been an instructor when I was in college. He was a graduate student, and then I worked with him all through graduate school. He was a faculty member by then, and we worked very closely, and we became very, very good friends. But my first year in graduate school, I realized that in a lot of our meetings, and I was in a small seminar with him with three or four other students, I always had the feeling, I often had the feeling, that I didn't understand what was going on and what he wanted and what he was talking about. And his style was one that most of us, faculty, kind of adopted naturally, which is being authoritative. We sound really like we always know what we're talking about. And it's very important in teaching. It's also important to recognize that it's bullshit, and that's, you know, but we do it. And you have to figure out when to do it and when you're doing it too much. Because it's very easy when you have a large group of people who aren't as experienced as you are to make things up and sound like you really know what you're talking about. And you're winging it. But anyway, he always often made me feel like I was really dumb. And he never was critical. It was just, I never quite understood what he was asking for, the connections he was supposed to make, that I was supposed to make. And he would often bring in literature and connections that he apparently understood, but he assumed I understood. And so I constantly felt that he was expecting me to be a hell of a lot smarter than I was. And I didn't know how to deal with that. And after about 6 months of it, I finally said, you know, I always feel dumb, I always feel stupid, I'm always confused, and maybe I just need to put that out there. You know, maybe I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe it's okay to say, I don't understand that connection, could you explain that to me? And other students were in the same position I was, and so I became the person who would say, John, I read the assignment, but I don't have a clue what you really are looking for. And none of the other students would kind of, oh, yeah, good, I'm glad somebody said it, because they didn't have a clue either. And so John would start to explain it, and he'd get halfway through it, and he would acknowledge it didn't make any sense to him either. And it was lots of fun then, because that's what our friendship became based on, that we became really, really honest with each other and able to tell each other, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what that study means. I don't know what you're asking for. And then we became very, very close, and I stopped feeling stupid. But he was really messing with my head for a long period of time, but it wasn't intentional, and I was letting him do it. So stepping back and saying, whoop, wait a minute, I can't go through graduate school feeling stupid. So, short story. It's an unintentional game. But he played it with everybody. I watched him do it over and over and over again. And we finally got close enough that he would ask me to call him on it. He said, so when we were working together on things, if he said, if other people don't seem to understand, let me know that. And so I would. I would just step in and say, John, I don't think, I'm not sure people are clear on that. And there was a secret little smile, and he would say, okay, let me start over. It worked. Okay, other things that go wrong. Are there other games that you're aware of that happen because of trying to understand each other?
Silence.
Silent treatment. Oh, yes. None of you ever do that one. There's a technical term for that. It's called stonewalling. It's called, I am a stonewall, I do not hear, I do not speak. And it's your fault if you don't understand me. I'm not going to explain myself, because you should be able to read my mind. And if there's conflict between us, that's obviously somebody else's fault, and I don't know how to deal with it, so I'm just going to sit here silently until you straighten up or bail me out. I'm fine. Sure. When there really is conflict, and conflict avoidance is part of the strategy, so what you're seeing in those situations is people who are on a collision course because there is disagreement, but one of them can't deal with it. And one of the ways you deal with not being able to deal with something is to deny it. And when that happens, from a Bronfenbrenner point of view, you want to think about the definition of human development, right? Valid view of the world that you live in, and that includes yourself. People who don't understand themselves can fool themselves into saying, I'm fine, when you can tell from the blood pressure, from the rigidity, from the snappishness, they're not fine, they're falling apart, you know, but they can't deal with that within the context of a relationship. So they deny it. And what that tells you is that they don't have the valid view of themselves or the situation, or they don't have the skills. That's the other part of the definition, the skills to maintain the relationship in the face of the conflict. Some of us don't ever learn, some of us have difficulty learning and aren't taught when we're young to be able to deal with emotions and to be able to deal with conflict. We learn to avoid it. We learn to deny it. And when that fails, then we fall back on the, it must be your fault, and I'm just going to sit here absolutely quietly and stonily, I'm going to be the stone wall, and let you dash yourself upon me, but that's not my fault. What that represents often is a very low-level ability to deal with emotion. And when you don't have other skills, protecting yourself is about it. And stonewalling is better than one of the other low-level skills, which is lashing out and blaming. So when somebody is threatened, when there's a sense of conflict, some people hit. Some people scream and yell, and the affect gets pretty negative pretty quickly because they can't deal with conflict at all. The next step up from that is, I can't deal with it, so I'm just going to sit here silently. There is some literature that suggests that some of us do the stonewalling as a way of avoiding that lowest level response of hitting or lashing out. That we don't want to do that, and we know that, and one way to do that is to remove yourself psychologically from the situation and stonewall. There's a healthy way to stonewall, and it's a skill that people can learn pretty quickly. You may have to teach them, but instead of being stonewalled, you can suggest to the person who's doing it, I understand you may not be ready to talk about this. When will you be? And let the person choose, and let the person tell you, okay, it's going to be 3 days, next Wednesday at 10 o'clock, I'll be ready to talk about this. And then leave the person alone. There was a hand. I'm going to come back to that point.
Yeah. But many of us have a great deal of difficulty with difference, with different expectations, with different understanding, and Tupper Schwartz mentions that couples who are happy understand that they're different, that there are differences between them, and they're accepting of that. And that's a more valid view of the world than the one that says, you have to be just like me. You have to agree with me. You have to think like me. You have to behave like me. If you're going to be in a relationship with another human being and you don't have an identical twin, it's likely that you're going to have some differences. And one of the things that helps in creating a relationship is to understand that we're all different. There's no way we can be the same. And in fact, we're attracted in part to differences, but we have to be able to respect those and understand each other's position and be able to deal with them not as sources of conflict, but simply differences. That's great. I'm glad you feel differently than I do. I'm glad you like something different than I do. The problem with difference is that some people are threatened by it and feel that if somebody is different from them, that person must think that they're wrong. And some people deal with their differences that way, rather than saying, I feel differently, which is a nice, honest, straightforward statement, they say, you're wrong. Because they don't accept that other people have the right to be different and should be respected for the differences. Then you explore the difference. How did you get there? That's interesting. How did you get interested in that? How did you come to define that word that way? That's interesting. Let me think about how I did that. So you share reciprocally, trying to understand the other person's world. And that's part of the fun of relationships. But that requires a good deal of maturity to be able to accept the difference. How do you avoid debating? Yeah. Why does it become a debate? What? Different. Well, what do you do with differences of opinion? Do they have to become debates? No. Okay. Why do they become debates? They become debates when people can't accept that the other person has a right to a different opinion. When the other person needs to be right and convince the other person rather than try to put both viewpoints out in the most articulate way you can and figure out where they came from. Why does this person see the world differently than I do? Can I explain why I see it this way without creating conflict in that? You don't have to agree with me. And I don't have to agree with you. What I want to do in a relationship is understand you. And part of what we're doing in adolescence and beyond is trying to figure out how to be different from other people and understand them. Some of you who took HDFS-5, we've talked about Harry Stack Sullivan and his notion of intimacy and creating intimacy, interpersonal intimacy with friends or lovers is based on being able to accept the other person and value and love the other person in spite of the differences. A couple of my favorite books about relationships focus specifically on that fact that we're different. And these two books happen to focus on male-female differences because you can't get much more different than male and female. You can argue with me if you want. But one of them is a book by a woman named Jocelyn. And the title of her book is The Space Between Us. And she talks about strategies for bridging the inevitable space, distance, difference between people. And the other one is by a local author, Polly Young Eisendrup, was a therapist here in town. She wrote a book called You're Not What I Expected. I love the title. But it's a book about the fact that we all have a tendency to expect somebody to be just like us, and when we find out they're not, we get annoyed with them. And she said people have expectations of partners that are often, I don't know, they come from our childhood. Some of you started dreaming about the ideal relationship when you were 5. You were planning your weddings, right? You know what your dress is going to look like. You know what the names of your first 7 children are going to be. No. Right? You've been planning that. Those are expectations. Those are the creation of images. That's what Galinsky's book is going to be talking about in part. But that applies to relationships too. You have the expectations, and they're never going to be met by a partner. Ever, ever, ever. So you have to figure out what you do with expectations that are different. You have to be able to modify them. And again, if you read Schwartz, one of the things that you need is flexibility and the ability to change your expectations. To plan things together and collaborate in ways that, she doesn't use that word, but that's what she's talking about. The ability to do something together that isn't what either of you expected, to adapt together to the reality of who you are and what you're doing. And couples who can do that are happy. And unhappy couples say that they can't do that. I want to come back to the stonewalling silent treatment. There's a wonderful article I don't assign in this course, but probably should. By a psychologist named Bergman, Steve Bergman. And Steve has been studying relationships. Actually, Steve isn't very famous, but his wife is a psychiatrist who's really famous for contributing to a relational view of development. And one of the things that Steve has done with her, they do workshops for couples together, and that's they talk about relationship. And one of the things that he says is that many men, and I'm going to stereotype this because we are much more likely to stonewall, though I have personal experience with women who stonewall, so I know it's not just men, and it's not all men. Bergman talks about relational dread. D-R-E-A-D. Dread. Some people dread the emotional work of relationship because they've never learned to do it. It's like, you know, if I were suddenly told that I was going to play point guard on the UVM team Friday. Right? I don't have any skills for that. I don't even know how to put those baggy pants on. How do they keep them up? I don't know. Anyway, some people have about as much ability to do relationships and to do the emotional work in relationships as I have to play basketball in NCAA tournament. So what happened, you know, we have dreams about that stuff. You know, you have that dreaded dream that you go into an exam, final exam, and of course you aren't taking. You don't know anything about, but there you are, you're in the exam, and you wake up all upset. I would have that kind of experience if they put me on the court for the game. Some people have that experience of dread when they are faced with an emotional conflict with their partners, particularly with their partners, because they don't know what to do with it. And Bergman says that one of the typical reactions is that there's a little thing going on in the relationship, and he uses the stereotypic, so I'll paraphrase him and use the stereotypic, but again, it goes both ways, gender-wise. But one person says, I didn't like the way you... Why did you do that? And they have a little tiff. And she, typically, Bergman says,
will ask, well, how did you feel that? Why do you think that? Why would you do that? And this is a question that Bergman says requires vocabulary about feelings and motivations. And you, in order to answer the question of what were you thinking, what do you feel, I want to know what you think now, in order to answer that in the context of an upset partner, you have to have the vocabulary. So, well, I was thinking about this, and I was feeling exasperated, and I know it's not your fault, but most of us don't have that vocabulary. A lot of us don't have that vocabulary. So we have to sit and think about that question. And while we're sitting thinking about that question, the partner who's waiting for an answer is used to, if she's female, she's used to her peer group batting around vocabulary about feelings and exploring them and tearing them apart and thinking about them and arguing about them. And he, with his friends, will do the same thing about basketball teams, but never about feelings. This is really stereotypic stuff. And so he's searching for the vocabulary. Let's see, what was I feeling when I was doing that? Let me put myself back in the situation. And she'll put up with that for about 30 seconds, and then she'll say, well, which makes him more upset. And because now he's not only wrong, but he's incompetent because she expects an answer now, and he doesn't know what he thinks or feels. It's going to take him several hours to figure out what he feels. And Bergman says the problem in the couple relationship is that she wants to thrash it out and talk it out right now. He can't do that until he's figured out how he feels. Because if he starts talking about how he's going to be wrong, and then she's going to play head games with him and challenge his understanding, and, you know, and she probably will. And then eventually, she's going to back him into a corner in which he can only sit and stonewall. So he's just going to... It's time for the game, time for the news, I'm going to read the paper, I'm going for a walk. And she's really annoyed because that's not the way she wants to deal with it. Bergman's advice to women or anybody in that situation is to recognize the anxiety that you've created by asking the other person to be self-knowing and to reveal. Recognize that anxiety, call it dread. Okay, the other person needs time to deal with this. And that's why I suggest that, I know you're not ready to talk about this now. When will you be? When would you like to? We'll make an appointment and then lay off. And that's Bergman's advice. He said, when you're getting stonewalled, make an appointment for talking about it. Don't criticize anymore, you know, because you're just digging a deeper and deeper hole that the person's never going to climb out of. But he said, typically in couple relationships, what he sees is one attacking because the other person can't deal with the issue in the same way and won't talk about it and needs to stonewall, needs to hide for a while, and instead continually gets attacked until he blows up and goes out for bread and never comes back. There are some strategies. One is recognize when the other person is not able to talk about something now. Define what you want, which is to know what the person is feeling, and you'll accept that tomorrow morning. Bergman says what really is ironic in conflicts like that is the guy goes out and takes a walk. By the time he gets back, she's in bed asleep. But he's figured it out. He actually, two or three hours later, understands what he was feeling, what he thinks, what he wants to do, and is ready to apologize. So at breakfast, he says, you know, about last night, hon. And she says, what? She's way past that. And now he wants to talk about it, and she's not, she's on to something else. So that relationship is a problem, and that's why they end up in couples therapy with Steve and his wife. Another strategy is the one that you teach the person who is having difficulty explaining him or herself, and that's effective stonewalling. And I learned this from a friend and then then found it in a couple of books, but it's a very effective strategy when you know you don't know what you're talking about and you don't know how to talk about it and you're not ready to talk about it. This friend taught me this. She, under stress in a conversation, does this. I love it. She will say, "I'm confused. I need to think about this. Don't talk."
And she literally puts her head down in her hands.
There's nothing you can do when a person says,
"Give me a minute."
And that minute may be 2 or 3 or 4. It always seems like an hour and a half. And she's thinking while she's doing it. She's got to put it together, and she can't do that while she's looking at you and engaged in the conversation. So she does temporary stonewalling with permission so that she can think. And then when she's ready to talk about it, then she's there. And what Bergman trains people to do is to say, "I'm just swamped, I'm flooded, I really can't talk about it. I don't know how to talk about this right now." And rather than do a bad job of it, "I'd like an hour and a half, and then I'll come back and tell you what I think." And go do it. Shoot baskets or whatever it is that you want to do, and you come back and you got it figured out. But the problem is the different style, he says, in relations that some of us want to have intense going at it, and we're comfortable doing that, and some of us aren't. We need more time. We need lots more delay for thinking when we're learning to talk about conflict and emotional things. The comment is that, I'm going to expand it, the women are much more likely to do more than one thing at a time. And there is some literature that suggests that, experimental literature that suggests that women multitask more effectively than men do, that men do one thing at a time. And in the emotional realm, that's more likely true, that men are likely to have one emotion at a time and be able to talk about it and think about it. And women are all over the place. The interesting thing is that there are two macro systems here, one male, one female. And one set of beliefs is that you ought to be able to multitask and do 6 things at once. And the other one says, pay attention to what you're doing and do 1 thing at a time and finish it and then go on to the next thing. And if you understand that there are different macro systems involved, different belief systems that support the individual style, then you do research that points out that, in fact, when you force women to do 1 thing at a time, they do it better than when they're doing 6 things at a time. That's a male study, right? We like that one. That doing 1 thing at a time is eventually more productive and effective. The reality is that there are many situations where you can't do 1 thing at a time. You just don't have that luxury. And when somebody's pissed at you and annoyed and you're trying to change diapers and get the car ready, you got to multitask and you better learn to do it. And one of the ways you multitask is to avoid the emotional stuff. If you've got multiple things to do, it's sometimes easier to just stuff the feelings and not tackle them. The question is, we're talking about different, when people have different styles in dealing with conflict, and having different styles sometimes creates the conflict. But what happens when people have the same style, and they like to go at it tooth and nail and put all those feelings out there on the table and thrash them out? They usually have very dynamic and happy relationships, in part because they don't have to deal with the difference. They understand each other better as adults. One of the things that characterizes relationships where both people have difficult temperaments is that they have a lot more conflict, but they're often very, very close because they really understand each other well. And they often can have a blowout, and 2 minutes later it's done, and they don't dwell on it. Some of us who are much slower spend a lot of time holding grudges and thrashing things out. I don't want to get very much deeper, because I'll fall over some kind of precipice very quickly in talking about relationship dynamics. But what else did you run into? And where are the... what did you write? What are the kinds of problems that people run into? Power issues. How do those come out? Okay. The one person is exerting power, the other allows that to happen and doesn't know how to deal with it, and one person ends up running the other person's life. Right. And have you lost friends to that? Yeah. You watch your friend gradually become under the thumb of somebody who is really abusing him or her, and you see the person that you like losing his or her individuality and not doing the things that he or she likes to do and letting the other person make all the decisions, and those are often very difficult. They are power imbalances, and the inability to maintain yourself in the face of somebody else's exertion of power. One of the reasons that often happens, I think, is because people are desperate to be in a relationship, and they'd rather be in a relationship that is not good for them than be in no relationship at all. And one of the important things in helping somebody, you have two tacks you can take. One is to help the person become more assertive, and that usually creates conflict in the relationship, that you can support the other person for standing up for him or herself. The other tack you can take is helping the person understand that it's better to be by yourself than in a bad relationship. But that's a very difficult thing for people to decide, particularly young adults who are very concerned about whether or not they're lovable. And when you're trying to develop, as Erickson calls it, a sense of intimacy with somebody else, you have to be in a relationship in order to do that. That's what it's about. And not to be in a relationship, for some people, leaves them with the threat that they're not going to be developing appropriately. The fun thing that happens in my experience with people who are in relationships that aren't good for them, when you support them to get out of them, there's a great deal of anxiety about getting out of the relationship, about ending it. The other person really is powerful, and it's hard for a person to end a relationship where they're being submissive, because you really have to stand up for yourself to get out of it. And I usually intervene when I see a student's performance going way down and the student begins to look really, really sad and, you know, things not happy. And then I wonder, and I'll ask, if you're my advisee, I'll ask you about your relationship and question whether it's good for you or whether you might be better off taking some time off from relationship. And the fun thing is that when those relationships end, the students always come in and say, it was really, really, really hard. And I'm really, really, really sad, but I feel really, really, really good. I feel really relieved, and I'm maybe I'll never be in a relationship again. And then they come in 6 months later and they're in a new relationship that's wonderful and they're having a great time. And I should have ended that other one earlier. I should get those testimonials on tape and play them in here. Because they universally will say, you shouldn't stay in a bad relationship. Get out quick. There will be other people and they'll be better for you. Okay, what else happens? Trust. Cheating. Nobody mentioned that one? Okay. Doesn't happen anymore. Used to. Oh, you did? You cheated?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah. Irresponsibility. Yeah. It's really not fun to have your partner tell you considerably after the fact about an incident of unprotected sex that he or she has had. It's especially not fun when that comes along with a visit from the health department that says, oh, by the way, we need to inform you that you have been exposed to fill in the blank, and you've been named by your partner as a sexual contact. Or when you go to the doctor and have your own exam and discover that you have something and the only place you could have gotten it is from your partner. And then the partner stonewalls. That's a good time not to fess up. If you're irresponsible, untrustworthy, a lying son of a bitch, then you do that. And the thing to do with relationships like that, cut them off at the knees immediately. You don't want that. Where's advice to the love Lord? I'm probably in over my head. I should. Okay. Quick, rescue me. Read Pepper Schwartz. And let's talk about briefly, and I'll put this up on the web. It's not there now, but dating, right? You're developing a relationship. How does the developologist point interpret that? Okay. Dating is for the establishment of relationships and finding out if you're going to have a primary dyad that works, that's comfortable. So, can we get all the romance out of it if we take a theoretical perspective? Of course we can. There'll still be some in real relationships, but at least in the classroom we can take all of the fun out of them. Except the fun of trying to figure out how to apply Bronfenbrenner. So there you are. Two people you met, you're attracted. We can talk about chemistry, why you're attracted to particular kinds of people. That's partly biological, and it's partly magic, and it's partly liking how the other person moves and how the person responds and tone of voice and all that kind of stuff. And it's lots of magic, but it's a different course. So from a developmental point of view, what are the proximal processes involved in establishing a relationship? Well, the first thing that typically happens is people start exchanging their views of the world, talking about their interests, their molar activities, the developmental trajectories, where'd you grow up, what have you been doing, what do? How did you do that? And talking about past and current primary dyads and macrosystem experiences. Now that's just finding out about the other person's ecosystem. And ideally that's reciprocal. But you both have to be fairly willing to talk for that to happen. And ideally, you both have to be willing to listen and ask questions. And that's where the reciprocity becomes important. If you're going to learn about each other's ecosystems, then you want to have reciprocal self-revelation. And ideally, in dating, you're finding out about the other person's ecosystem. And you're interested in doing that. So, here's a test. Early on in the relationship, you've talked a lot about yourself. You want to find out if the other person is a potential good partner. Give an exam. give a quiz. Just ask a bunch of questions about things that you have shared about your past and your interests and yourself, and find out if the other person remembers any of it. If he or she doesn't, then you might want to project that as you're thinking about your wedding and your 25th anniversary party. Do you want to spend a lot of your life with somebody who actually doesn't listen to you and doesn't remember anything about you? Probably not. So either teach the person to listen or bail. And in that situation, what you're exploring from a developmental perspective is the affect. Do you enjoy talking to this person? Is this fun? Do we have a great time? Do we feel really good about talking with each other? Do I feel like I could talk to this person for forever and listen to this person? It's always interesting. Or is this pulling teeth? And do I feel depressed after I've been with this person for a while? If the affect is negative after you've been with the person or while you're with the person, usually we're pretty good about bailing. Over time, what are you learning about power? What are you learning about reciprocity with this person? You don't have to play games to do that. You just have to pay attention to what goes on between you. You want to enter each other's ecosystems. You're finding out about each other's ecosystems, but you also want to enter them. If there's continuation of the dating relationship, then you're going to get into the other person's settings, whatever those are. Are they comfortable for you? Does this person hang out with other people who are not comfortable for you to be around? Do you see your partner taking you to a setting and not introducing you, not telling you about the setting before you get there? Which hypothesis is that? It's going to be good for your development if you have valid information about it and know what to expect. So do you get the courtesy of being told what's going to happen and who's going to be there and how this particular setting works? Or do you get taken along and dumped while the person goes into a familiar microsystem pattern and leaves you out of it? Are you there because the person needed somebody to be with as a date? And there you are. I have to share a wonderful conversation I had with a friend who's in the dating game again in her late 40s. She was going out with a guy whose primary interest was whether she was dressed appropriately and would look good on the back of his motorcycle. And she said after the third or fourth date, she realized that the best way to describe her role in his life in their dating was that she was the accessory behind him in the saddle seat of his Harley. And it was important that she looked really good there. But he was taking her places where his other Harley riders, and these are upper middle class Harley riders. Harleys are expensive, and these are the guys with foam and great paint jobs and real helmets. Instead of colanders. And she realized that all she was an accessory to his Harley, and that was her role. And she wasn't really meeting his friends, he wasn't really including her in anything, but she said he would have been very, very happy if she had been really, really cute on the back of the motorcycle and then just stayed there while he did whatever he wanted to do with his friends. Okay, what is the affect of people in that microsystem? You got roles, relationships, and activities in any microsystem that you go into. How do you feel about it? Are you comfortable with the roles? Does the other person change in a different setting. Now, most of us play different roles in different settings. You have the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde phenomenon that you're dating a person, you go into her microsystem, into a setting that she's comfortable with, you watch her with her friends, and you don't recognize her. She's different in ways that you may or may not like. What does that tell you about the person's identity? How is the relationship going to survive that very long? How does the other person relate to, a very important one, how does he relate to his mother? Uncle Larry advice. Probably the most important information you can get about a person is how he or she, either one of them, relates to his mother or her mother. If a person does not like her parents, I get real skeptical. If a person really likes his parents or her parents, then okay. You probably have something solid there. And the experience of growing up might have led to appropriate skills. But if a person really doesn't like his or her parents, you might wonder why. You might ask about that. What's the trajectory? What's the developmental history there? One of the things that you do in dating is create joint activities. Do you enjoy the things that you're doing? Are they becoming more complex? Why do one-night hookups at the beginning of freshman year not lead to relationships? They don't, you know. How many of you are in a committed relationship with somebody you met having sex first year of college? Okay, are you ready for the next question? How many of you had a sexual relationship on a first or on a no date? Some of you did. Okay. I was going to do the percentages and figure out how unique you were. Because I think you're fairly unique. And I think the percentage is fairly... What happens in those relationships? The sex is really, really, really good, right? That's not what the literature on first sexual experience says. It says it's actually really, really, really bad. And it doesn't get more complex and more satisfying because it usually doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't continue. But in those relationships that are based on the sexual attraction and the sexual activity, when sexual activity becomes the molar activity of the dyad, it's sometimes difficult to add another molar activity that's also interesting to that, and then you have a very narrow range, and the variety and structural complexity of the molar activities that you're engaging in the dyad stays very small, just sex. And if a relationship is just sex, it's not likely to continue very long. But some people learn that for themselves. Have a wonderful spring break, and we'll see you a week from Monday. And those of you who are staying for the retake, you can take a 5-minute break, cram break, and come down fairly close if you're taking the retake.
Visit me while you guys spring break. Is it okay if you come?
Do you want me to? Excuse me.